ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm going to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the horse trading and politicking continues in Parliament, the government may be considering expanding exemptions to its capital gains tax changes. And the opposition has unveiled a political wedge of its own, threatening to withhold crucial support for Labor's NDIS overhaul if they don't get an inquiry into CGT and negative gearing changes in exchange. Meanwhile, the government has announced a major welfare shake-up, but new inflation figures and the return of more so-called ISIS brides could steal some of the spotlight. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm David Spears.
And David, we'll come to the negotiations in Parliament in a moment. Mm. But first, though, hot off the press. We're recording Wednesday. The CPI, which is, of course, the inflation figures for April, have just landed. April's inflation rate has fallen to 4.2%, down from 4.6% recorded in March. Automotive fuel prices, yeah, you know what that's about, fell 7% in April after rising 32.8% in the previous month. We know what that's all about, obviously. Strait of Hormuz being closed, the Middle East war. This is the first month that the cut in the fuel excise has been in force, and that's helped this result too, isn't it? I mean, this is sort of half good news, but it's a good today story, but there is a broader inflation problem still.
Oh, sure. It's still got to get down within the Reserve Bank band. But Cozzy lives, PK. Cost of living is still the number one issue in any poll that you look at, right? Far and away, this is the biggest thing. It's no surprise to anyone. Everybody knows this is number one. This is why it's always such a red hot political issue. What we see today is inflation for the month turning the corner, coming down. 4.2% is lower than the market was expecting. I think they were saying 4.3, 4.4. So it's coming lower than that. Look, there are a bunch of factors, and Jim Chalmers pointing to them, but the big one is fuel. You mentioned it. March, fuel goes up a third, 32 and something percent. And in April, because of that excise cut, it comes down 7%. It raises the question, will the excise cut be extended for another 3 months? As we record this, the Treasurer's on his feet. I'm sure he'll be asked, and I'm sure he won't answer. They haven't made a decision. They won't make a decision until closer to the time as to whether to extend that for another 3 months. But it does provide, it does what it's intended to do, forces down that headline rate. I guess the unknown is, will businesses be factoring in that that higher fuel price is going to persist and maybe jump back up again once the excise relief ends? Are they then going to push up their own prices? And so we have this ongoing inflation problem. The underlying inflation rate still remains at 3.4%. In fact, that's edged up just a touch from 3.3 to 3.4. So it's still a problem. Just looking quickly at what economists are saying, the markets are now lowering their expectations of a rate hike, another rate hike in June, which is good news. And I think some are dampening their expectation of another rate rise at all for the rest of this year. Of course, anything could happen. Who knows what Donald Trump and Iran will agree to or if they'll agree to anything. And that's kind of where we're all looking to see how this all ends. But yeah, it's a bit of welcome news, a bit of welcome news. What did Jim Chalmers say? It's gone down a tick.
A tick.
It's tick down. It's more than a tick, but it might just be artificial because of the fuel excise cut is the point.
I think that's all right. But if you think about the last couple of days, in terms of a slow burn of some positive news, yesterday it was, you know, your electricity prices are going down.
Yep.
Today, inflation ticking down broadly. I'm not saying we're in any amazing economic shape because that's deluded, but these are two headlines that the government would welcome in telling a story perhaps of a shift of sorts.
Yes, I think the electricity price, and I know you spoke about this on the pod yesterday, I think this is really interesting as to whether it does mark a turning point in this whole debate about power prices going up and up and up since the Ukraine war, and roughly around the time that Labor came to government, it's been a pressure point for them. But have we now seen a turning of the corner? Will these very high electricity prices start to continue to fall, largely because of the flood of batteries that people are whacking in their garages, and the grid-scale batteries as well? But anyway, that's fascinating to watch. Mm. I think the broader inflation point, though, look, let's not get too carried away. It's a one-month figure. As I say, it's the fuel price that's done it, that's helped bring it down. Housing costs, though, just looking at the data today, still up 0.5% for April, 6.3% annual. What does that tell us? Housing is still a real problem and a real driver of inflation. Maybe this is what the government can point to and say, this is why we're doing what we're doing in the budget. They want any excuse, don't they, to talk about where they want the focus to be post-budget, and that is changing the negative gearing rules to help more younger buyers into the market, even if that does mean existing homeowners are going to see some flatlining or even falling in their property price.
Yeah, they are. So let's go to the argy-bargy in Parliament now. A bit going on in the last 24 hours, it's fair to say. Let's go to the report in the Nine papers that the government is considering expanding CGT concessions amid backlash for small business, although I don't know if it's just the Nine papers that know. I mean, I've confirmed that in a couple of interviews now, that it is wider. They were really... Daniel Molino, who's the assistant treasurer, has spoken to me. He's quite, out of everyone, I've got to say, the most explicit about it. He's quite a good communicator, that guy. Yeah. Watch that space. But he's like, no, not just on startups, not just on tech. It's a wider consult. So very much the Prime Minister also confirming, yeah, speaking to COSBOA, ACCI, like all these big business groups. It's a watching brief, but David, they are alive to this. They just don't want there to be a huge back down because they still think the principle here is worth fighting for.
So there's two things I reckon going on. One is the consultation on the capital gains tax change, and the language from the PM, the Treasurer and everybody else is we're looking at the arrangements for tech and startups. Right, and they're not signalling there that it would be much broader than that, I don't think, for hairdressers and Pilates studios and catering businesses starting up. They're not necessarily going to get a special...
Cleaning businesses. No. Have you seen all those memes?
Anything that already, without getting too technical, if you're coming off a zero cost base, like a startup in tech is, then you're going to be punished by this change they're making in capital gains tax. But if you already have big cost inputs, like setting up a hairdressing salon, that you can then see growth from that, then you're not going to be necessarily worse off under what they're doing on capital gains tax. So they are talking in limited terms about any carve-out for tech and startup. Secondly, though, and separately, there's this question of how do you define a small business?
Yes.
And at the moment, and this is the thing, PK, it's been, I think, at that $2 million turnover threshold for a very long time.
So it's
2007, yeah. I think, since that.
So it's a reform that they're looking at quietly and increasingly noisily, if you read between the lines, at that four criteria that exists, right, for getting an exemption as
if
it
you're
stands,
a small business.
Which is 90% of small businesses.
Yeah, more than that, I think, yeah.
Yeah, 91%, I think, or 92%. Like, it's very close. Is looking at an expansion perhaps of that, or the definitions of that $2 million turnover is
like
one
you
of them.
Lift that to, look, I don't know the numbers on this. Maybe this is way too expensive, but if you lifted that to $10 million and said a small business is now a turnover of up to $10 million, would that go a long way to satisfying the concerns here if they could all enjoy those exemptions and concessions under capital gains tax? I don't know. Look,
But how would that affect the revenue you bring in? These are the questions that I've asked, but I actually don't feel like I have answers to in terms of, you know, and then there's Matt Common, for instance, from the CBA, who says just ring fence it to just property. You know, there's been calls from significant figures.
I thought that was interesting on 7:30 last night, the CBA boss. Look, I don't think from what I'm told we're going to get answers on any of that this week. That may change. They'll introduce the legislation tomorrow on Thursday, but those consultations on small business, tech and startups are going to continue. I don't think we'll see that this week. It's clearly live. Consultations are underway. The pressure will keep coming from the opposition in the parliament on this. But just to reflect on what we've seen in the parliament so far this week, PK, I don't think Labor is feeling... I mean, yeah, they know the pressure is there. I don't think question time has troubled them too much, or any of the specific examples that the opposition's bowled up. And amongst the Labor, you know, backbenchers, front benches I've spoken to, there's a kind of a determination to fight now on this. So I don't know. I don't see the government caving quickly is kind of the read that I get.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate read. And they think that, like, I mean, I spoke to someone who said, you know, do you think in Bass and Braddon, they're two, you know, Tasmanian seats, they really are crying about tax and CGT? Like, no. Now, I get that. Although, of course, the thing about politics is that sometimes, yeah, they're not sort of in the details or the weeds, but impressions can grow. And if an impression grows that the government is anti-growth, anti-jobs is the message, that can be a problem for you.
Oh, absolutely. The government's going to have to keep an eye on that. But I think in terms of impressions, you know, you can see the Prime Minister was quite emotional on the weekend at the Labor conference in Victoria, talking about trying to help young home buyers get a go. And you can see every opportunity he gets to take one of the opposition questions and turn it into, well, that young person would have a better chance of getting a house under. You can see that, you know, coming back to that point, impressions, the PM's pretty good at grabbing hold of something like that, making the emotional argument about helping young buyers locked out of the market. So I think that the debate just feels like it's got a way to play.
I agree.
And yeah, they'll need to settle what they're doing for startups sooner rather than later, and for small business for that matter. But I don't think they're going to be rushing it this week.
I don't think so either. And we know that two tranches of the legislation, broad parameters. So they don't, you know, let's go to the way they're doing that though, because they're trying to wedge the opposition quite obviously by putting all of it together. Now the opposition obviously is in favour of the Watto, the tax offset. They're not in favour of all of the other tax changes, which they've cast as tax increases. That's how they frame it. So, David, they also want to link their support for the NDIS changes to the government agreeing to a wider and comprehensive inquiry into the tax changes. Are they going to hold firm on that? I mean, that's what they're threatening. But, you know, NDIS cuts, they have to support that if they are true to anything that they've been banging on about for a long time.
I think so. And I think they will. They're keeping their options open. What's the language that they're using? That we don't have that many tools at our disposal, so we're going to look at the tools that we've got. And as you say, one tool may be to say, well, we ain't going to pass the NDIS cuts you know, in the timeframe that you want, unless you give us a proper inquiry into the CGT changes, the capital gains tax changes. Ultimately, though, yeah, I think it would be a problem for Angus Taylor to vote against the NDIS savings.
Now, one of the things that I want to say is I'm pro-inquiry always.
Yeah.
And so would you be, because we're journalists and we believe in scrutiny, right? However, I understand why the government doesn't want one or doesn't really want a lengthy one. Politically speaking, do they want something where, you know, a gazillion people front up and say, oh, I'm going to be paying more, I'm going to close my small business, I'm going to... You know what I mean? You can see why they want to contain this thing.
But there should be time to do this, frankly.
Oh, totally. I'm an inquiry girl. Yeah, I believe in inquiries.
They've got until July next year.
Yep.
I know that for political reasons they want this passed lickety-split, but... Yeah, there should be time for an inquiry. So I think the opposition is right to raise that point.
It's a very reasonable point to want scrutiny. Yeah. But you can also see why they want it, which is not because, to be also very accurate, not because they want to properly scrutinise the bill. They don't want to vote for any of this. They want it so that they can expose the flaws, if you like, of the tax changes.
Yeah.
They can get maximum coverage for their campaign. So everyone has an agenda, is my point.
I don't think there'd be much point in an inquiry, though, until the government's settled what it's doing in terms of any carve-outs.
Until there's actually the details.
Exactly.
Because it's about the interaction in the tax system of how things work, right?
Yeah, I agree. So, look, I guess ideally settle that first, then have a good look at it all, and then let Parliament decide. But politics... has a way of overriding some of these things.
Now, a couple of other things I want to talk about with you, David, and that's 7 women and 12 children, all Australian citizens, touched down in Sydney and Melbourne airports from Syria on Tuesday. We're recording this on Wednesday. No arrests were made this time. And David, the government, of course, has repeatedly said they don't want the women here. They obviously have some sympathy with the children, but that they played no role in the repatriation. It was all self-organised, self-funded, self-done. But opposition leader Angus Taylor is out today saying the government rolled out the welcome mat. This is tricky for the government.
Yeah, look, I don't know. They quite rolled out the welcome mat, but this is the point that Angus Taylor and the opposition's been making for a while. They shouldn't have given him passports. They should have issued more temporary exclusion orders and so on. We'll see if any arrests do happen. Remember the cohort that came earlier in the month? I think, was it the next day they were actually charged, or the day after a couple of them were charged? So, you know, as we record this, still no charges have been laid against this latest cohort, but we'll see. I guess the only good thing for the government is that there's now only one woman and child left back in Syria, the one who did cop the temporary exclusion order, and her child is staying with her in Syria. So it's not like there's another group that we're sweating on and, you know, constantly reporting on, will they, won't they, how will they make it back? These groups are now back. The unknown is whether any trouble is going to ensue. The government can only hope that the agencies have this, as they say they have this. They are going to be keeping a very close eye on them all. They say they have been keeping a close eye on their activity for some years while they were over there. Presumably now they'll have a much better opportunity to keep an eye on them. And yeah, the government can only hope that no problems arise with this group.
Well, in some ways, this group, it's expensive to monitor them.
Yeah.
So I understand the politics there, you know, spending a lot of money on this cohort that I don't think many people have a whole lot of sympathy for broadly, although of course the children are, you know, it's an obvious point to make, but you know, you've got to feel sorry for the innocent victims here, which are always children. But you know, I'm always worried about the people we don't know.
This is the argument that Jamal Reefy made on 7:30 and has been making for a while, that you're better monitoring them here than letting them be further radicalised over there. Look, you can see why people are sensitive about this, and particularly after what happened to Bondi. There is very real concern about this cohort being here in Australia. So don't want to play that down at all.
Mm. It's entirely rational.
Yeah, but it's just a really difficult one for the government when it comes to Australian citizens seeking to return home.
Yeah, it's easy for the opposition to say, just block them all. You know, we do have laws and citizenship is a bar and it matters. You know, there has to be hard to deny citizens the right to come home. Look, I want to just pivot before we go to the other big piece today, which is a really big deal. It used to be very much, you know, one of my areas, one of my rounds when I was a junior journo, and I love this stuff, and that's the employment services, the unemployment welfare system being overhauled by the government. Like, this is actually a big deal. It's the biggest shakeup in about 30 years. I think I reported on the last one. Employment Minister Amanda Rishworth is speaking at the National Press Club imminently, as we record. She's speaking it as a once-in-a-generation reform. A key component will be an overhaul of mutual obligations. Now, mutual obligations, to give people a little backstory.
Yes, take us back 30 years.
I will.
Because this was the Howard government's baby.
The Howard government's baby. You know, things like Work for the Dole, which are kind of iconic signature sort of right-wing policy that was very populist, actually. We talk about populism now. That was early populism, the idea that people, if you're on the dole, you know, you should do labour for that. Yep. And, of course, really contentious about whether it's good or not. That's the back story. Things have evolved a lot since then.
So I think
the idea of having to do something for your welfare.
Yep, there was Work for the Dole, and then this mutual obligation of, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was you had to do 10 job applications every fortnight originally back then. It looked, Labor has wound that back to now. Nowadays, I think it's 4 per month job applications. So it has changed a lot. Mm. But the further changes Amanda Rishworth is going to be talking about today, well, I think there's going to be an expert panel, working group, discussion paper process. There'll be a process, right, that follows this. But what she's flagging is a more tailored model, right? Mm-hmm. Because the problem is you've still got way too many people who are just long-term unemployed or are coming into the system, maybe get a job, then, you know, they're cycling through the system. What were the figures I was looking at? This is from a couple of years ago. 2/3 of participants have been on the books of employment agencies for more than 12 months, 160,000 more than 5 years. I think the numbers might have even grown since then. 20% of the work of the caseload have been stuck there for 5 years or more. So clearly for a significant cohort, PK, the system is not working.
It is not.
Sure, you can have them filling out job applications. One of the reasons they wound back the number of job applications you have to do is employers just get sick of it, right? They get flooded with so many ticker box applications that it was creating a lot of problems for business as well. So they're trying to make it more tailored, have three streams, I think is the idea here. Sure, there are people who are job ready. They can be in a stream that says, you know, bang, bang, put you back in a job. Another stream that clearly need work to upskill, and a third stream that have perhaps more significant issues that need to be dealt with to get them back into the workforce. But does that make sense? As someone with the long history of covering this, PK, does that make sense?
It does make sense at face value, like devil in the detail always, but it needed a shake up.
Why now, I think, is just worth touching on as well, PK. Unemployment last week ticked up to 4.5%. That's still historically low. But if it's heading higher, if we're heading into trickier territory in relation to our economy, and if unemployment is going to keep rising, we need to be on this. The other big structural change, of course, is AI. Mm-hmm. Now, what's this going to mean for employment? I think is one of the big debates, big questions around the world. But if we are heading into a territory of higher unemployment, we need to make sure we get these settings right. So it probably does make some sense to be having a good look at this now and tailoring employment services to ensure that they are delivering what we all need as a nation.
I think you're right. And AI is going to smash young people.
Yep.
It's a really big issue.
Yeah.
And I don't know, anyone who is in our generation, Gen X, millennial, and has kids, I reckon this keeps a lot of parents up at night. Does me, and it sounds daggy, but it does, because I think all those entry-level jobs, I look at them absolutely evaporating, and I worry for my daughters because they're the sort of jobs I know I got, you got.
Yeah.
If they're no longer available, that's going to be a really big problem for our kids.
Look, it is a worry. And look, this sort of thing, this change is something that the government's own Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee has been on about for a while as well. That's the committee that looks at the level of job seeker and so on. But this whole architecture that we don't often look at, haven't looked at much for the last 30 years of helping job seekers. What is it? About $2 billion of government money goes into these agencies.
It's huge.
It's a lot of dough.
Yeah.
We want to make sure we're getting something efficient.
And that the reward goes to those who do that harder work rather than the quick fix, the quick match, which they tick and flick sort of stuff.
Yep. Well, look, is it going to be brought back into government? I don't think that's the impression they're giving. You know, go back to the old CES days. But
a few years ago, Julian Hill, who now is an assistant minister in a different portfolio, oversaw a big review into this.
Yeah.
And he was really pushing for Labor to adopt a sort of broader. They're not going as far as that, but, directionally, the idea of profit providers, just kind of banking money from the taxpayer but not doing the deep work that needs to be done.
And look, in fairness, I'm sure many of them do a great job.
Yeah, and adhere to the rules, and they're the rules that
big
are set.
Big non-profit providers in that space as well. And, unscrambling the egg and taking this back into government is probably too far. But, let's see what they come up with here, because for various reasons, as we mentioned, it's probably a good idea to have a good look at this.
Yeah, for sure. That's it for Politics Now today. David, thanks for joining
me. Thanks, PK.
And you'll be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday. And I think you've already got your guest locked in.
I know. Do you know Everil Compton? You would know Everil Compton.
Of course I know him.
We should let people know.
He is a legend.
He's 93. Mm. He's been in this building, well, not permanently, but visiting prime ministers in this building in various capacities. He led National Seniors for many, many years. Yeah. But anyway, since Robert Menzies was prime minister, Everil Compton has met every prime minister on various issues. He's currently pushing for a private consortium that he's a part of to pick up the Inland Rail project. Remember, what was it, a few weeks ago, government said we're going to halt it at Parkes. He's got a private consortium that wants to run it all the way up to Gladstone in Queensland. So he's been meeting the PM this week. It was his 126th visit to Canberra, he told me. So he's met them all, every PM.
I just love that he's counted it.
How about that? How about that? He's met them all.
I love a tally.
Chifley, Curtin,
And he's also just a really likeable, passionate man. So very exciting that you're doing that. Okay, if you've got a question for us, please send a short voice note to theparty room@abc.net.au. Fran and I will try and answer it in a special edition of The Party Room. See you, David.
See ya.